The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Rebecca Donner. Rebecca Donner is the author of the novel Sunset Terrace, referred to by the Baltimore Sun as the remarkable story of a community of single mothers and kids in 1980s Los Angeles. Her other work includes the graphic novel Burnout, as well as essays, reviews, and articles that have appeared in a variety of publications, including the New York Times, The Believer, and Guernica. The recipient of a fellowship at the Leon Levy Center for Biography, Donner has taught writing at Columbia University, Wesleyan University, and Barnard College. She is here tonight with her new book, All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days, the true story of the American woman at the heart of the German resistance to Hitler. In it, she explores the remarkable life and brutal death of her great-great-aunt, Mildred Harnack, the leader of one of Nazi Germany's most successful underground resistance groups and the only identified person from the United States to be a leader in the German resistance. One review of the book reads thusly: combining meticulous scholarship and sparkling narrative brio, Rebecca Donner's All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days brings to life for the first time the central role played by Mildred Harnack in Germany's homegrown oppression to Nazi rule. Donner's portrait of the cruelly oppressive system against which Harnack and her circle fought serves to remind us of what can happen when, amidst economic insecurity and anguish over dislocating socio-cultural change, a highly civilized nation embraces demagoguery over democracy. Coincidentally enough, that very praise was written by tonight's interviewer, David Clay Large. He is a professor at the Frohm Institute at the University of San Francisco, senior fellow at the Institute of European Studies at UC Berkeley, and author of 10 books, including Berlin, Where Ghosts Walk, Munich's Road to the Third Reich, and Nazi Gang. Rebecca, David, thank you both so much for being here, and the screen is all yours.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Why don't I start out? I'll say a little bit about Rebecca. I'll repeat some of the things that were already said, but I wrote them down. I'll be damned if I'm not going to say them. And then I'll say a little bit about the book, after which I will then pose some questions to Rebecca about the book. She will respond. We'll talk. We'll go back and forth on those questions for a bit. And once we're done with that, then we can have Q&A if that's agreeable to all of you. And I hope it is. Better be, because that's what we're doing. as you just heard, you know, Rebecca has done a lot of things. She's really a triple threat, which I find very impressive. She's been a journalist, a very active journalist. She's a novelist, a damn good one, and she's an historian. So as a triple threat, you know, she has three really interesting books to her credit. One was already mentioned. It's a terrific novel called Sunset Terrace, set in a seedy section of LA in the early 1980s. I recommend it highly. Another, Burnout, which is a graphic novel about eco-terrorism. I mean, talk about a wide range. She's got it. And then finally, the historical study that we're going to be talking about tonight, entitled All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days, which takes us deep into the milieu of domestic resistance to the murderous regime of Adolf Hitler in the 1930s and early 40s. It's of course that last just recently published book that is the subject of our discussion for this evening. I probably don't need to remind you, I'm sure many of you already know, that this book has been almost rhapsodically praised upon its release. I mean, it makes every author envious to see these reviews. I mean, it's eat your heart out. But there are at least, I mean, there are two in the New York Times alone, two really fantastic reviews in the Times, one, I think August 3rd, if I'm not mistaken, and another August 6th. If you haven't read those reviews, do so, because it'll inspire you to read the book, which you also better do. Now, from my own perspective as an historian of modern Germany, that's what I do. And I'm also an historian of the resistance to Hitler. I've written a couple of books about that. From my perspective, there are several aspects of this book of Rebecca's that really stand out and make it special and worthy of note. One, you've already heard mention of it. It has an unusual personal dimension to it because the central figure in it, Mildred Harnack, was the great great aunt of Rebecca Donner, right? So you have this personal connection, which you often don't typically get in books of this sort. Mildred Harnack was an American woman from Wisconsin, who moved to Berlin to be with a man she had just married, Arvid Harnack, who was a brilliant intellectual from an illustrious German family. They met in Wisconsin, they got married, and then in the summer of 1929, they moved to Berlin. A very difficult time to move to that city, but that's what they did. And so they get caught up immediately once they move there in the meteoric rise of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party to power, which is accomplished 3 years later in January of 1933. And then they get caught up, and this is the essence of the book, in an embryonic opposition to Hitler's rapidly established dictatorship. So the first special thing is this connection that she has with Mildred, which I think gives it a special flavor that you wouldn't otherwise get. The nature of the opposition group in which Mildred Harnack became active and a leader indeed, gives this study yet another note of singularity, in my view anyway. And that's because the group was largely civilian, not exclusively, but largely civilian. And the domestic German resistance to Hitler has gained by far the most attention from historians. The group that has gained the most attention from historians has been the military and the military intelligence branch. I think it's safe to say that's where I'd say 80% of the attention of historians has gone, not so much to the civilian resistance. And so it's very important to have this emphasis on that aspect of resistance, because ultimately it was much broader than the military opposition. So everybody knows about Klaus von Stauffenberg, right? And the circle of military intelligence people around him who tried to kill Hitler on July 20th, 1944. That's well established, but much less so is, as I say, this civilian component, which is the focus really of this book. Not so much Stauffenberg and his group, though they come into it obliquely. Another issue is Mildred's gender. You know, she's a woman, and it's noteworthy that this is at play here. She was by no means the only female to become active in anti-Nazi resistance or to sacrifice her life in that cause. There were others, to be sure. But the female component of Germany's domestic anti-Nazi opposition, like the civilian dimension, has needed more fleshing out. More, if you will, personalization, right? And that's where this book comes into play. I mean, it really puts a personal face on the extremely important female component of Germany's domestic resistance to Nazism. The French resistance has gotten a lot of that already. You know, we have lots and lots of biographies, works on French female resistors, but the German one, not so much. A little bit Sophie Scholl, of course, with the White Rose, few others, but that's important in this book, to my view, as an historian of the resistance. And the fact that the face in question here, Mildred Harnack, happened to be American, will certainly be of special interest to American readers of this book. I think it's useful to keep in mind that the same state that gave us Senator Joe McCarthy also endowed us with Mildred Harnack. Right, so that American connection is really very interesting, and it remained an American quality to Mildred Harnack throughout her life. It's an American story in part, and that I think needs to be kept in mind. The final note of specialness and I think I find this really very significant. Final note of specialist I want to mention is the way in which the story is told by Rebecca Donner. Remember, she is an accomplished novelist. And this book, without sacrificing one iota of scholarly precision and rigor, is written with the born novelist's feel for atmospherics, for contingency, drama, and the mysteries of the human heart. It's a great read. It's a great read in addition to being a great contribution to our understanding of how anti-democratic tyrannies can become entrenched and how difficult it is to stand up to them, much less bring them down once they have become entrenched. Hence, in other words, this is a damn timely book, right? I don't need to remind you all of that. It shouldn't necessarily be read just in connection with what's happened in this country, but that's part of the story and it's the elephant in the room and you can't avoid that. And I think it's useful to keep that in mind. All right, so with that background about Rebecca and about the book she's written, it's very brief, I know, but I wanna give her a chance to talk about her own work rather than have me blabber on and on about it. I'd like to pose some questions to her. Starting with this one. Can you, Rebecca, describe a little bit for our audience the Berlin scene in which Mildred Harnack and her new husband found themselves, or 29 and 30, when they arrive in the country? I mean, I've written a book about Berlin. I find Berlin a fascinating place. I'm sure you do as well. But what's
I've read it.
yeah. So the Berlin scene.
Wonderful book. Yes.
Yeah.
The scene. And thank you, David. That was a gorgeous introduction. It's a real honor to be speaking with you tonight about my book. In 1929, Mildred joined Arvid in Germany, and she enrolled in a PhD program at the University of Gießen. Over 50% of the students there were affiliated with a Nazi fraternity, and she was really astonished. This was not the Germany that she expected to arrive in, and neither really was Arvid. I mean, I think it has to be remembered that the Nazi Party in 1928, the year before they arrived, got less than 3% of the vote in a Reichstag election. And in 1930, 18%, but we're still the margins were much smaller. And then of course in 1932, 37%. So there was this rapid increase, this meteoric rise in the popularity of the Nazi Party. And Mildred bore witness to this. And in her letters to her mother, she spoke about this. And she both spoke about how she was delighted to be in a PhD program, to be taken seriously as a scholar, to be working on her dissertation. It must be remembered that Mildred grew up in an impoverished circumstances in Milwaukee. Her mother was a suffragette with a 10th grade education who taught herself typing and shorthand in order to make ends meet. And her father was a frequently unemployed horse trader slash butcher slash insurance salesman. You get the picture. And so Mildred didn't have any real mentors. And here she is now getting her PhD in Berlin. Those early letters, 1929, 1930, 31, 32, she's going to lectures, she's delivering lectures, she's going to concerts. She's taking in the culture of Berlin and so there is a sense of her being enraptured with that. This was foreign to her. I say in my book that the only play she had seen was on the furnished or was presented on the varnished floor of planks of her high school gymnasium. And I'm quoting myself and I can't remember exactly what I said, but it was more or less that idea. And, and now she's just, she's taking in all the culture that Berlin had to offer. And during the Weimar era, there was a whole lot of it. And there was that sense of At that point, it was there was still freedom of the press, freedom of you could practice whatever religion, you could demonstrate in the streets. There were 90 daily newspapers in Berlin alone, which is astonishing to me to consider. I just try to visualize that, taking the U-Bahn and seeing all this, just this array of newspapers that people were reading. And she wrote about this too in her letters, and also on the kiosks, just this fantastical array of reading materials representing everything from the far left to the far right and everything in between. So you have this sense of plenty in her letters and her and really that's my portal into her mind and heart are those letters, which my grandmother gave me when I was 16. And you also get the sense of the tremendous strife, and she wrote about these encounters, strikes that were happening, that incredible poverty, and she was deeply moved by the struggles that Germans who were unemployed were clearly having. And she would see lines of people in shanties, begging for food, and so there, and the gap between rich and poor was quite pronounced. And she felt, in many passages in her letters to her mother, she spoke about the necessity to do something about this. One of my chapter titles is "We Must Do Something About This Now," and that's a quote from her letter that she wrote to her mother. So she also felt obligated to, in this foreign country, take it upon herself to try to do something about it. And so this was now her transition into the underground resistance.
Yeah, it's important to remember, I think, that the Depression hit Germany probably harder even than it did the U.S.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because Germany was so dependent on U.S. capital.
Yeah.
And once that dried up, there was this complete, utter hopelessness almost. I mean, the unemployment just went through the roof much, much more rapidly than in the U.S. So this was a desperate situation. And so you've got Mildred there suddenly confronting all of this, and she begins to get involved a little bit in underground activities. I mean, once Hitler had actually come to power in 33, can you tell us a little bit more about how that happened and who it was that she began to try to recruit and to work with and the circumstances surrounding all of that? Because it's an interesting introduction into this world that would ultimately be her life and her death.
Yes. Well, I think so she was teaching at the University of Berlin, and while she was working on her dissertation, she was teaching American literature. She was lecturing, she was rather forthright about her political views. She was also had an eye out for recruits, so she would invite students who she felt would be receptive to joining a kind of an underground. At that point, it was a nascent kind of thing. That come over to my apartment and let's have a chat, about the political situation. Or she would actually start out by just saying, "Would you like me to loan you a book? And let's talk about this book." And then she would, by various incremental steps in this way, kind of suss out the person's political views and receptivity to an anti-fascist movement. But again, in 1932, this is before Hitler became chancellor, was appointed chancellor. So she was fired from the University of Berlin, and she quickly got a position at a night school for adults, for working class Germans who had not gotten their degree. And it was the first school of its kind in Berlin. And it was actually started by a German man who had gotten the idea, who had lived in the United States or had visited in the early 20s and imported this idea back. And here was where Mildred found a pool of recruits. And these were working class Germans who were very much being targeted by the Nazi Party with propaganda. And she also started a club. She called it an English club, but it was also a way of basically bringing in people, academics and people at the US Embassy. Messerschmitt came in and spoke. And it was a way of bringing, again, some ideas to Germans, these working class Germans that fell outside of what they were hearing. Or the propaganda they were hearing. Again, this is before Germany was still a parliamentary democracy at this point. Then Hitler became chancellor, and then everything changed. And overnight, and we saw that very rapidly. In an eye blink, Germany progressed from a parliamentary democracy to a fascist dictatorship. Mildred stepped up her efforts to recruit, but she had to be a lot more careful because if she recruited the wrong person, she could just be turned over to the Gestapo. So the primary weapon that this group had was paper, leaflets, pamphlets. And this, to our contemporary ears, sounds rather mild and effete, but really in a fascist dictatorship, if you're caught with a leaflet that is denouncing Hitler or the Nazi Party, you will be sent to a concentration camp. And that is exactly what happened to several of her recruits. And they were there for a year. Then they were let out, and then they came right back into the group and kept going. And so you get a sense of the commitment of these people in this group. It was a diverse group. There were Jews in the group, Catholics in the group, atheists. They were factory workers, they were professors, they were students, they were artists, there were office workers, and they were communists and social democrats. After 1933, those parties became illegal. So they were covertly affiliated, or in their hearts at least, called themselves this, and 40% were women. So this, and over the course of about 8 years, this group, it was a scrappy group that sort of certainly there was no sort of central organization. When we think of a group, or even when you use the term leader, I'm always a little uncomfortable saying a leader, because we envision this sort of hierarchical structure. This was by design. They did not, a lot of times, this was in a post-war testimony, Wolfgang Habermann spoke about this. He was a survivor, and he spoke about how they didn't tell each other's name. They didn't know each other's real names a lot of the time. This was more as we approached the Second World War. In the beginning, everybody was still just figuring it out. But as they started to think about how really 1935, 1936, 1937, it became apparent that Hitler wasn't going away. Initially, there was this perception, well, Germany is not going to stand for this. He's just a buffoon, and nobody takes him seriously. And the Conservative Party thought that they could manipulate him and control him.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, I know. I don't have to explicitly draw the parallels. They
no, right, exactly. There. They're right there. They're right there.
And but then toward the mid-30s, they started realizing, we have to change our strategies. That's around the time when Arvid, I didn't finish my last thought, but I was going to say that this group over 8 years intersected with at least three other underground resistance groups, forming a kind of interlocking chain. And they didn't, around this time, roughly maybe 39, 40, it's hard to say when, but when the group began to, members of the group were getting recruited. The men were getting recruited to fight. Other members were getting, again, arrested. And so they thought, we have to be much more careful about avoiding arrest. So nobody knew each other's first names. And the idea was that you had these sort of small cells that were linked. So if one person got arrested, you could only, and if you were tortured, as sometimes happened, you could, and if you broke, you would only know two other people who you could name, and then you wouldn't know the person's real name. But going back in 1935, that's about the time that they just changed their strategy. So this is when they realized paper is a poor weapon against a fascist dictator. Leaflets aren't enough, and they expose them too much to arrest. And so this is when Arvid Harnack, Mildred's husband, got a position at the Ministry of Economics in order to have access to top secret information about Hitler's operational strategies. And he discovered that despite what Hitler was telling the world and Germany, that Hitler was preparing for war. And then he passed this information to the Soviets.
Soviets, exactly.
Yeah. And then eventually, and then he also, and this is a fact that is not quite well known, and this was one of my objectives in this book, was to bring news about this, but they also, Arvid and Mildred, shared this information with the Americans as well.
Yeah, so they got into spying as well, though that wasn't the original intention. The original wasn't it just to call, to bring to the attention of the Germans what was happening and to try to get them to stand up for something. And that, you know, it's hard for us to realize, I think, today just how risky this was in that environment.
It was, in 1939, you could get executed for listening to a foreign radio broadcast. And this is astonishing to us.
That's right, you weren't supposed to
listen. It's an act of treason.
Broadcast, obviously putting up posters, distributing leaflets could get you into big trouble. That happened to the White Rose, this group down in Munich, who were doing some similar things as Harnack was doing up in Berlin. And of course, it was absolutely deadly. We have to keep in mind that this took incredible bravery, and there was a risk. I mean, when you have an organization like that, it's inevitable that there will be penetration of it. It cannot be avoided. And so you do get ultimately arrests, including in 42, the arrest of Mildred. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that transpired? The arrest of of Mildred, and then we can talk about prison and so forth afterwards.
Absolutely. Well, I also want to point out, you brought up the White Rose. Yeah. Falk Harnack, who was
Arvid's in that. Yeah, brother, was part of that.
Was in that. Yeah. Yeah. So I think I also have encountered. Yeah, right. I've encountered this perception that the underground resistance groups weren't connected. They very much were. They knew there were sort of thin. I imagine sort of a webbing, you know, that connected
right,
them.
Right. Which was both advantageous and disadvantageous. It was good in the sense that they had connections, but that could expose them then to further arrests and expansion of the arrests.
Yes.
She gets arrested and. And tell us what happens about, I mean, how she got arrested.
Yeah.
Who did it?
When several members, Mildred and Arvid included, became sort of during the war desperate to try to help Hitler's enemies, they stepped up their acts of espionage. After their sort of central contact at the US Embassy in Berlin was transferred to Santiago in 1941. Their only other option was to just pass all this intelligence to the Soviets, which they did. Arvid was extremely hesitant. He did not want to be a spy. He was very insistent that he was an anti-fascist. He would say, "I'm not a spy. I'm not going to accept money, and I'm not going to take orders from a control officer." And in some of the memos that I have read that have since been declassified and released, his control officers would bemoan the fact that that Arvid could not be ordered around.
Wasn't the kind of spy you wanted, right?
Yeah,
not a docile figure.
Exactly, but they said, well, you know, he's got great intel, basically, and so did Harald Schulze-Boysen, who was a lieutenant at the in the Luftwaffe, and he had knowledge of missions and incredibly specific information that was very advantageous for Stalin to know about. The problem was Stalin didn't believe any of it. And he was so, at this point, paranoid that people were trying to stab him in the back. I mean, but one of the documents I also, that I include in my book is the report that included the intelligence that Harold Schulze-Boysen and Arvid Harnack presented, or as a compilation of their memos, and other sources as well. And Stalin scrawled across the top of it something, actually, maybe I won't say it, very something profane. You can read the book.
And that's Stalin. He wasn't noted for
to do with something about
his delicacy of expression.
What they could do, yes. It was,
yeah, exactly.
A Russian historian I was working with said, you know, this is profane even for Stalin, what he wrote. So that's in the book. I mean, I have a scan of that page. And then Barbarossa happened, and the Russians were trying to give to the Berlin group now radio transmitters so that they could basically send the information to Moscow Center, and they were poorly trained. I go into this in great detail in the book, but there were two or three transmitters. Two of them broke. They had to take them to be fixed. Again, this is during the war, so transmitting these things, transporting these things was so. There were these cumbersome machines, and again. If you get caught with one of these things, that's it. So, and then they had to be trained, certain members. Hans Koppe was one of them, a German man, working class, in his early 20s. And he was very hastily trained by a Soviet agent to send messages via this radio transmitter, using Morse code. He had been working at a lath factory, and so this was that was his day job. And then after 10 hours, he would go home and then work at this machine. And again, there were if the Gestapo, caught the signal, then he could be arrested instantly. So tremendous high stakes here. Well, the Funkabwehr, the German intelligence, those who were sort of scanning the airwaves and trying to pick up messages, they caught a message, and then they spent a year trying to decode it. And they succeeded. There was a huge team of the finest decoders and mathematicians who were assigned to the job. And after a year, they cracked the code. And I'll just sort of make this as brief as possible. It's a lot more complicated than that, but essentially they cracked the code, and then the Gestapo pounced. So the first person was arrested, Harold Schulze-Boysen, and then his wife, Libertas, found out about this and spread the word and hopped on a train and tried to escape, and she was arrested. And the same person who arrested her, Horst Kopka, also went in pursuit of Mildred and Arvid. By this point, Mildred and Arvid had fled Germany, and they were in, at that point, Nazi-occupied Lithuania. They were planning to escape by all accounts, by all available evidence. They were trying to escape to Sweden. And they stayed in, they met up with a couple, Egmont and Anneliese Zechlin, and they sort of gave the appearance of having a holiday in Nazi-occupied Lithuania. This is falsely reported in other books. They just say that they were having a holiday, and Mildred and Arvid just decided to go to Nazi-occupied Lithuania to just soak up the sun. This is actually how it's depicted, and that's wrong. They were escaping, attempting to. Because of Egmont Zechlin, we have an eyewitness account of what exactly happened the morning they were arrested. And he's a historian. And he wrote an article about 7 pages long after the war in minute detail, including dialogue. It reads like a novel. Dialogue between Horst Kopko, Gestapo agents, and Arvid and Egmont and Mildred and so forth. Actually, Mildred doesn't speak. So Egmont Zeppelin reports what happened. Basically, the Gestapo agents arrive at the door. Arvid's outside and they surround him. And Egmont, everybody in the house can see what's going on. And they're not sure who are these men. They're plain clothes, you know, and they look official, but no badges, you know, and they walk in, and one of and Arvid says, according to Egmont in his article, "Oh, these men are with the immigration. They want to see, you know, my papers." And right then everybody knew these were Gestapo. And so then Egmont and Annalisa tried to detain them. "Oh, have some breakfast, have some coffee." And Egmont said he kept trying to get close to Arvid to whisper something in his ear or to receive a message. Really, he thought maybe Arvid would say something to him about what to do next. And every time he got close, a Gestapo agent would come in between. And so that was the day of their arrest. It was the morning. And I should also point out, Horst Kopko drove with his, he was an SS officer, drove 500 miles in person. He wanted to personally arrest Mildred and Arvid. And then they were taken to Gestapo headquarters and thrown in the basement prison there. And then over the course of 3.5 months, they were all, I actually have it in my book, I feature their Gestapo mugshots, if you can see, yeah, of some of the members of this group. This is, to my knowledge, the only book in the English language that features this array of mugshots, of Gestapo mugshots. There's one out of print book published in Germany decades ago that has all of them. And that's the only one that sometimes you see one or two, but not the full array. The Gestapo arrested 119 members of this group, men and women, and then they were interrogated over the course of the 3.5 months. And this continued in, this is 1942, it continued into 1943. Regarding Mildred, she got the Gestapo mugshot, she was fingerprinted, and then she was put into solitary confinement. There's a lot more I could say about that, but anyway, that's the arrest, and all of them were then interrogated, tortured, a lot of them, including Mildred, and they were preparing for a mass treason, a top secret mass treason trial. It was a bogus trial. That there was no justice served, but they wanted the appearance of justice, basically a great number of them were executed as a result of that.
Now Mildred originally, as you point out in the book, she, originally after her trial, she was given a sentence of six years.
6 years, yes.
Imprisonment, whereas her husband Arvid was executed, was hanged.
Yes.
But she was given this prison sentence. It delighted him. He thought, well, at least she's going to perhaps get out of this.
Yeah.
But then what happens? What happens
Yes, then so actually the one of the people who was in the room reported later that they saw Arvid's, they just found out he was about to be executed, but he was beaming when he heard Mildred's sentence. Now we also have to remember that that he had relatives who were in the Valkyrie plot, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Klaus Bonhoeffer.
That's the Stauffenberg.
Yes, Valkyrie, right, exactly. And Hans von Dohnányi and Justus Delbruck and Ernst von Harnack, all of them were executed. Eustace Delbrück shot himself.
The July plot to kill him.
Yeah, in the July, 1944 plot. So it's, we wonder whether how much Arvid knew about, you know, in his family, we have no idea. Yeah. But in any case, there was at least the hope that she would survive. If every plot failed, Mildred would be sent to a camp, prison camp, and 6 years, well, at the end of 6 years, she would survive. Was his hope. And then 2 days later, Hitler found out about the verdict and her sentence, and he ordered a reversal. And there was
her via Goering, right? Didn't Goering hear about it first? And then
yes, he did. He was irate.
These were people from the elite whom Goering thought were his friends, and now
right. Oh, he was, yes. He was livid. And it's interesting, she's very classist.
Discredited him, he thought.
Goering had no idea that there were academics, you know, aristocrats in this group. Yes, and this is what made him, apparently, according to this SS officer who was interviewed after the war, all the more irate. That people like Arvid and Harald Schulze-Boysen and Mildred and those
I think it made him feel that he might be suspect himself. I mean, if there was, yeah. These were people from his same social group.
Yes.
Then, you know, it would discredit him.
Right.
In his constant war with Goebbels and other high-ranking members of the party.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. So basically Mildred was rushed through a second trial, and she was found guilty and was given a death sentence. And on February 16th, 1943, she was strapped to a guillotine and beheaded.
Guillotine. Yeah.
Guillotine.
That was the way the beheading was done for the most part, was guillotine.
Yes, it was the Nazi special perversity to feel, to view head chopping as more humane than hanging.
They're being humane, yes.
After she was beheaded, and this happened to all the women she was not alone.
Well, shot too,
beheaded. The other women were too, and the men were either hanged or shot. The women's bodies were delivered to Hermann Stieve, who was head of the anatomy department at the University of Berlin. And he had worked at a special arrangement with the director of the prison at Plötzensee prison to ship the women's bodies so that he could dissect them and investigate the effects of acute stress on the female reproductive system. And he kept a list, and I have a copy of the list again.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the spectacular things in this book. I mean, the way you flesh out all of this and the various pieces of it, which are intricate and unbelievably sobering and disturbing, to put it mildly.
Thank you, David. Well, I feel like we need to see the physical evidence because there's so much.
Yeah, well, that's one of the great things. Let me just segue into another question here.
With the
observation that, the book is filled with little pictures of documents and snapshots here and photographs there and pieces of dialogue. And this book is written in a way that's quite different than usual academic tones. It's written in the present tense, for one thing, mm-hmm. and it includes right in the text all of these little pieces of documentation, which I find fantastic, by the way. I think it's just great. But what led you to, was it your novelist's background, more or less, that got you into this? I mean, what made you to say, I'm going to do this way, as opposed to the more, if you will, traditional way in which any of those documents would end up in an appendix someplace, perhaps?
Right. I was acutely aware that I was doing something unconventional and that it may not be accepted. It was a risk.
I think it's great.
And that it would somehow invalidate my authority and the rigorous.
Yeah, you always worry about that. If you write in legible English, people, they think you're not serious.
right. Yes, exactly. Right. Obfuscation is the key.
Exactly. In the academic world, that can be kiss of death.
Yes, and then when you bring in pictures, so much the worse.
Oh God, no.
I started with the observation that there was actually already a biography, sort of conventional cradle to grave biography, as you might characterize it, of Mildred already, Resisting Hitler by Shireen Blair Breisach, that was published several decades ago, two decades ago. And so I thought, that's already been done. And so I need to have a fresh approach. And so that was sort of observation number one. Observation number two was, as I started researching in the archives, I was just fascinated by the documents themselves. I love getting my hands on the documents. I love and just feel the history. And then I started thinking, you know, history feels, we have this sense of it being so sort of dust caked and sepia toned, and it's so distant. And then when I began thinking about how topical this it is, I felt this was in the run up to the last presidential election in 2016. I need to tell this. I mean, I've been researching it before that, but this was when I really began in earnest to write the manuscript and because I felt like it was important for people to see this history is relevant, and it is important to see how fragile a democracy can be, and how important it is to resist. And the story of these resistors, I was well aware of, sort of steeped in mythology and inaccuracies and falsehoods. And so I thought, how do I make it more relevant? And more immediate? And I could say a lot more about this, but I see we want to take questions. Sure. But basically, yeah, that was sort of how I came to deciding. Yeah. I'm going to interweave these documents so people can see the power of the story is that it is true. A lot of editors say, well, Rebecca, why don't you just write a historical novel? And I said, you know, swimming your own lane. I actually had
something. No, that's, you did the right thing.
Yeah, thank you. And yeah, I thought, you know, right, so thing. I wanted to bring the story to bring it to vivid life and to show in the present tense, to bring a sense of immediacy, you know, to the reader. So.
And that you did. So we actually only have around 10 minutes left, I think. So we better get in the question.
Yes.
We better let the audience have a.
Let's hear your questions. I'll try to speak really quickly.
Let them into the,
We'll get to as many as we can. And I'm jumping around. And if I miss yours, it's entirely personal.
exactly.
Okay. So there's a question here. That's an interesting one. Was there any sexism within the movement?
Oh yeah, definitely. Actually, Greta Kukoff, one of the survivors, who she wrote a memoir, and so we have a lot of information about the group from her. She spoke about how Arvid didn't wanted there to be a separate women's group, and so that the men could have their group and the women could have their little group. And she was outraged. Mildred led the women's group, and then eventually they merged. And then in 1935, Mildred started running the meetings, which is something that people don't ever talk about, or they don't know. They just assumed that Arvid led them. I uncovered archival evidence that this is what she did. And he was at the Ministry of Economics then. So, but yes, that's one example. I'm gonna just try to give short examples
we can get more questions.
That the women took all the chance. I mean, they were enciphering the messages that were sent to Moscow Center. They were hiding the transmitters. They were making the leaflets. There was one woman who was very gifted as a graphic designer, and she made them so miniature they were the size of a postage stamp. I can't even imagine this. But I should say a photograph, not the leaflet, but little photographs so that they could contain a small amount of text so that it could be easily distributed. Anyway, women were doing all of these things.
Talking about these other people, there's another question. I guess kind of taking it macro, does your book talk about other female resistance fighters such as Virginia Hall and people like that?
No, this is what I talk about is this group. So I talk about the German resistance. So Virginia Hall wasn't in Germany. I focus on the German resistance. Cool. Yeah.
Did the Americans reject the information from Mildred's group about Nazi atrocities? And I guess I am having sort of a larger question about, you know, the American reaction to her arrest, to her imprisonment, to her execution. What was America's role in this at the time, if any?
Good question, yeah.
The America's role regarding the Americans and the Brits both regarded those in the resistance and the German resistance who did, there are documented occasions when figures from the German resistance, including Arvid and his cousin, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Arvid went to the Americans, Dietrich Bonhoeffer went to the Brits and told them about the resistance, and they were treated with extreme skepticism and dismissively. The Americans and the Brits simply did not want to believe or did not believe that there was, there's a quotation from Anthony Eden saying, is there even any evidence of the German resistance? This was in 1942. I mean, he just didn't believe that it existed. And then after the war, I could say a little bit more about this very quickly.
Talk a little bit about what happens after the war when the, you know, the Americans and the Brits capture some of these guys, including the people who arrest and then prosecute Mildred, what happens
it's
to them?
It's just astonishing. CIC, in American intelligence, was on the verge of indicting the chief prosecutor of this that was responsible for this whole trial, and that sent he was one of the people responsible for sending Mildred to her death and who actually witnessed her decapitation. He was one of the men who watched. Manfred Roeder, whose nickname was Hitler's bloodhound. He was on the verge of being indicted as a war criminal in Nuremberg, and the CIC swooped in and gave him a code name, Othello, and decided to use him as a source to inform them about Soviet espionage. And so both Manfred Roeder and a couple other Nazis, Horst Kopko, who personally arrested Mildred and who presided over her torture, was recruited by the British intelligence. And MI6 faked his death, gave him the name Peter Cordis, and gave him a job as a textile manager of a textile factory. And neither man, and again, he also duped, his captors into thinking that he had this knowledge of this vast Soviet net of spies that was on the verge of toppling their democracy. It was just hogwash. Neither man was indicted at Nuremberg and tried as a war criminal, and they both lived out their lives.
And then they go on to discredit people like Mildred Harnack as commies. Then they discredit the whole legacy as being somehow connected to communism and therefore deserved what they got almost.
That's right. Well, actually one CIC official, and I have a letter, a memo that he wrote, her execution was justified.
Legitimate. Yeah.
And for an American official to say that an American woman who was fighting the Nazi regime and risked her life and lost her life in doing so, and who was beheaded, for an American official to say her execution was justified is just astonishing to me. But it does show how she was viewed through a Cold War lens. And that's her legacy for many, that's unfortunately
obscures the legacy for a long, long time.
I'm glad you asked that question. And then you encouraged me to speak further about it. Yeah, it's a really important point.
This is fascinating. And I think it runs very counter to, our very cinematic notions of the post-war and people getting their justice and that.
Just desserts, right?
Indeed.
Well, there was a man named Galen too, who was set up by the OSS and later the CIA to run the West German intelligence organization, who was a Nazi of the first order, right? Yeah. I mean, this is an old story. You can go on with Werner von Braun too, if you want.
Absolutely.
In the interest of time, I'm going to dovetail a couple of these questions because, I think people are probably reacting like I did to you showing the mugshots in the book, and there's a few questions about research. And one is, how much information, if any, is yet to be uncovered? Another one says, what archives did you explore? What surprises did you find in the archives? And I guess the big question is, how did you go about this research? And are there still central mysteries that you continue to investigate, or you've hit any sort of brick wall in your research path?
Yes, I mean, of course, I'm just going to show you this page. These, you'll see all the archives that I consulted. I mean, there are archives of Soviet era archives, archives in Berlin. Of course, the Gedenkstätte Deutsche Widerstand was an incredibly important, the German Resistance Memorial Center was an incredibly important archive. And Hans Koppe, who ran the radio transmitter, who was executed with his wife. His wife had a baby, was pregnant when she was arrested, and she gave birth in prison. Hans Koppe, the child, the baby, grew up to run the Gedenkstätte Deutsche Widerstand. So he devoted his life to the resistance after his parents had both been executed. Hans Koppe Jr. Gave me access to a lot of documents, including notes that were passed in prison between Mildred and her, and we don't have hers, but we have other women in the prison who wrote about her. Those are reproduced in the book too. Those were some of my most astonishing archival discoveries, these notes that were sort of, people would sew into their hems and stuff into the cracks and fissures of the prison walls. And this is how they communicated. This was a compound question. What am I missing? So what archives did I go to? Well, right, archival discoveries.
Right, just are there any central mysteries that still-
Oh, central mystery.
Lingering mysteries, yeah. Lingering mysteries.
Yeah, well, Mildred's older sister, who was my great-grandmother, urged the family after she was executed and after the New York Times in 1947 published an article saying an American woman beheaded on Hitler's direct orders. I'm paraphrasing the headline, but alluded to her being involved in a sensationalistic conspiracy. And this is already at this time, communism was being attached to her and sort of in obviously, a way that made her sister afraid that she too would suffer this, and her husband, who worked as a lawyer at DC, would lose his job. She urged the family to burn every letter of Mildred's and all of her photographs. And so when you speak of the gaps, there are gaps at that level. I have her letters from 1929 to the last letter that she sent in 1942. But there are some letters she sent to the family that were destroyed. They're just so happened that her mother hid that packet of letters that she received in the attic, and they weren't discovered until my great-grandmother died. So after my great-grandmother told everybody to burn everything, you know, that luckily there were some letters saved, and this is how I was able to get a lot of information. So there are gaps there. There are also gaps just in the letters themselves. She knew that she was being, her letters were being read by a Nazi censor. So she couldn't say everything that she wanted to, but you have to sort of read between the lines sometimes and just kind of guess at what she's meaning. There are gaps in, you know, these documents that the Nazi War Crimes Act 1998 that resulted in the declassification of a lot of documents, but they're still being declassified to this day. And when I was requesting files on Mildred, I got sent back files that were redacted with big black splotches all over them. And then I had to file FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act requests. And then they were denied. And then I had to send a second request. And then I succeeded in getting some of these documents declassified and unredacted, but some of them still are classified. So these are just some examples of the evidence that we don't have or that's being hidden. And in Russia, I mean, you know, we've been given a glimpse at some of these files, I mean, these NKVD files and GRU files. In the early 90s, historians were, it was just like a little peek, and then they shut again, and they're under lock and key. I wrote to the Russian embassy and introduced myself as Mildred Harnoff's great-great niece, and wrote a two-page letter basically begging them to share a little shred of a file of something. And they actually did send me something. And that's in the book too. They sent me a photograph of her espionage file, which blew my mind. And also some Cyrillic description about her, but it was the tiniest sliver. I think of Julian Barnes's definition of a net as a series of holes held together by string. And that's how I conceptualized this book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, I guess as the last question, and you're sort of segueing into it for me, so thank you. And it's a question that a lot of people are having in one form or another. But and I think it's something that's fascinating about, you know, this work of history too, is your personal connection to it. And while I imagine, you know, most of the people who knew her have gone to the great hereafter and their just rewards and whatnot, there's questions. What drew you to this? How did you find out about it? What has your family said? Like, you know, can you talk about the personal nature of this within your family and for you?
Sure, I'd be happy to. My grandmother, when I was about 16 years old, gave me Mildred's letters. She knew that I wanted to be a writer. I announced my ambitions and she said, you need to tell Mildred's story one day. And I felt a great obligation to do so. I kept those, I made two new copies for me of the letters, and they're somewhere, I feel like I have them out earlier. Anyway, it's a massive binder. And then I was, there was a kind of mystery that I felt about Mildred. I knew that my grandmother told me some stories, and then she passed away in a hit and run boat accident. So she had an untimely death, and I wasn't able to. There were still questions I had that I hadn't been able to ask, but she had told me enough, and then she'd give me the letters. So I started thinking of it as a kind of detective story, a scholarly detective story. And then I just, and she gave me Mildred's, these books of Shakespearean plays, A Midsummer Night's Dream. And I would look and see what lines she underlined, and then what did she write in the margins and why. And so I was just intrigued by the mystery of Mildred. And I had the sense that she was deeply misunderstood, and that, I thought, you know, I felt like I was gathering information slowly about her, and asking family members, and you know, what do you know and what do you remember, and then I tracked down her courier, her former 11-year-old courier when he was 89 years old, and I was at an artist residency in New York, and when I found out he was still alive, I leaped on a, I mean, I just I took a plane straight out to California, in Northern California, and interviewed him at length. And that really, he was probably the last person alive who had firsthand knowledge of Mildred's espionage and actually had participated in it. And that for me, that was the personal link. And he looked into my eyes and he said, I remember Mildred, and you are family. She is family to me. She was my Aunt Mildred, he called her. And so I think that experience really moved me so profoundly, if you're asking about my personal connection to the story, I felt like there were my grandmother's letters, Mildred's letters that my grandmother gave me, and then my interview with Dawn, and then everything in between. But those were the real focal points for me that just spurred me on, and provided this tremendous sense of urgency to tell this story. And also Arvid's last letter, which Mildred gave to her cellmate, Gertrude, and said, please try to give this back to the family. It's this precious thing. Right before Arvid was executed, he wrote this letter that is just a gorgeous testament of love and commitment. And it's so wise and it's so incredibly poignant. And Gertrude was transferred to Ravensbrück concentration camp, managed to survive, and kept this letter with her. And then in 1952, finally tracked down the mother, Arvid's mother, and said, I would like you to have this. And so this is why we have this letter today. And so that letter, now I'm going to keep, and one other thing, then also the name of this is how I'll end this. So anyway, that letter is really astonishing. It's reproduced in my book. We have it today because of Gertrude. And that was an act of heroism, just keeping that letter and with her at the concentration camp and keeping her promise to Mildred that she would give it back to the family. And then finally, one other document was sort of my personal connection. And that was actually the book of Goethe poems that she was translating in her cell right before she was executed. And Harald Kohlschau, who was the chaplain at the prison, found her scribbling in the margins and with a pencil stub. She was scribbling translations. And the title of my book, All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days, is a line from one of these translations. So hence the very long title. Sometimes people say, why such a long title? It's a line from a Goethe poem. And I felt that it really summarizes the themes of the book as well.
Well, I can't think of a better way to end, actually. What a nice wrap up that was. And what a terrific talk it was. Just for the folks at home, I posted in the chat one more time a link to the book. If you want to buy it, you can go to foxbookshop.com or wherever fine books are sold. And yeah, that'll do it for us tonight. David, thank you so much for joining us
and interviewing.
And Rebecca, thank you, David. I enjoyed our conversation so much.
Yeah, thank you, Rebecca. What a great book. Go out and buy it, people.
Well, that's two people saying it here. So now you have to do it, folks.
All right.
Great night.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.